today, the Democratic race to take on Donald Trump. And Daniel Boffey on what new leadership of the European Union means for Brexit. There is one thing on which all Democrats agree.
You talk to voters and they say the number one priority is to get Donald Trump out of office.
Donald Trump has been one of the most divisive, even hated presidents that America has ever seen.
Keep America great.
But as his base cheers and the economy booms, his critics are terrified that he is about to win a second term. After all, incumbents normally do. And so Democratic voters are consumed by one question: which candidate is best placed to beat him?
Often primary voters want the candidate who agrees most with them on the issues, so either a very progressive candidate or a very moderate candidate. But with Donald Trump in the White House, that's changed things, and you talk to voters who are trying to game this out and having a really difficult time.
Some say the safe option would be former Vice President Joe Biden.
Donald Trump thinks Wall Street built America. Ordinary middle-class Americans build America.
But now the race is shaking up as others look to more radical.
That's right. So for those for whom it's not working.
Diverse.
Es de presidente a atacar.
And left-wing voices.
Who is this economy really working for? It's doing great for a thinner and thinner slice at the top.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, who is breaking through in the Democratic race to take on Donald Trump?
The favorite, according to polls, is former Vice President Joe Biden.
Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for Guardian US.
Joe Biden has been leading the Democratic primary since before he even entered the race.
In a very clear message from Democratic voters in a brand new CNN poll, bring on Biden. The poll shows 62% of Democratic voters want the former vice president to enter the 2020 race.
But last week, we saw a lot of candidates really challenge his frontrunner status. We saw them both go on the attack against Joe Biden and definitely level some very serious critiques of his record and his past that I think expose some very serious vulnerabilities about him being the frontrunner and possibly the nominee.
The shift in the dynamic of the Democratic race has really taken hold this week. Polls had suggested a contest that would pit Biden's centrism against the more radical offering of Bernie Sanders just behind him. But in new polls, Sanders has slipped to fourth place, overtaken by Elizabeth Warren on the left, while Kamala Harris has surged into second place, closing in on Biden. She caught the attention of the nation last week when 20 candidates took part in two televised debates.
Maybe the most devastating line of these debates, where Kamala Harris interjects on a question about policing and racial disparities in the police force that wasn't directed to her.
We're going to get to you. Hang on. We're going to get to
you. Stage, I would like to speak on the issue of race.
And then she turns to Joe Biden. She looks at him in the eyes and she says,
I do not believe you are a racist.
And then she goes on and she begins first by calling him out for comments he had made, speaking fondly about his working relationship with two senators who, you know, were notorious segregationists several decades ago. And she said that was hurtful.
And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing.
And then she goes on to tell a story about how she was bused to school.
You know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
Busing is effectively where you take a student from one area and you bus them into another school district that's not in their neighborhood as a way to reduce racial segregation in public education. It's a controversial practice. It was then when Joe Biden opposed it. It is still now. It's quite rare to hear this sort of story about a very positive experience with busing. She sort of turned that on its head, and she explained that not only did this approach help a young black girl in Oakland like myself, but it launched my career, and now here I am, a U.S. senator running for president. You could see there was almost an indignation when she turned on Joe Biden. He was clearly taken aback by this attack. I don't think he expected it to be so visceral and so raw.
It's a mischaracterization of my position across the board. I did not praise racists. That is not true, number one. Number two, if we want to have this campaign litigated on who supports civil rights and whether I did or not, I'm happy to do that. I was a public defender. I didn't become a prosecutor. I came out and I left a good law firm to become a public defender.
And he said, I have a long record fighting for civil rights. Civil rights is actually what got me into politics. He even took a jab back at Kamala Harris saying, I became a public defender. You were a prosecutor. But then he sort of just stopped.
Anyway, my time's up. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Vice President.
Before the moderator cut him off and he said, my time is up. And that, I think, is really interesting. I think you might see that line played again. Is his time up? That's what the people on the stage were asking. Some of the candidates were being very explicit about it. Pass the torch, Joe Biden. It's time for a new generation to take over. And I think, you know, you saw them really question that. Are you the right person to lead this country with your very long record? Do we need a fresh start? Do we need someone new?
And it's interesting because when I was watching that, I didn't really fully understand what they were talking about in a way. Of course, we know about America's segregated past, but the idea of busing people, you know, a federal policy to bus people between schools to try and mix up different races is something that we don't really talk about here in the UK. What was she hoping to achieve through that?
I think she wanted to have him apologize or at least admit that he was wrong about a piece of his past. He has been incredibly reluctant to offer unequivocal apologies for any of his conduct or behavior. Several women have accused him of inappropriate behavior. He did not offer an apology for that behavior. He has instead said, you know, times have changed.
I shake hands, I hug people, whether they're women, men, young, old. It's the way I've always been. It's the way I've tried to show I care about them and I'm listening.
And I appreciate and recognize their experience, but he never apologized. And so I think what she was trying to do is she asked him directly, do you believe that you were wrong on this issue? And he said, no. Kamala Harris made a very bold choice to go after the front runner, and not just any front runner. This is someone who was the vice president to the first Black president of the United States. And he has a powerful base of support because of that. And those are the exact voters she needs. And she took a big risk going after him, especially on the issue of race and especially in the way she did it. So it was a big risk for a candidate who's known to be risk averse. And I think that you're seeing pay dividends for her because her fundraising has gone through the roof.
We begin tonight with what a difference a debate makes. A new poll just out today shows significant gains for Senator Kamala Harris and bad news for Joe Biden.
Early polling is showing that she's received a huge bump from that performance.
And look, she wasn't the only one going after Joe Biden. As you say, he's well in the lead in the polls. He's being portrayed by his critics at worst as someone who's willing to work with segregationists and at best someone who's offering no change at all. I mean, how would you characterize him?
Joe Biden wanted to be this antidote to Donald Trump.
The core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America, America is at stake.
He wanted to present himself sort of as a party elder and as this, you know, veteran politician, remember me from the Obama years. I'm the one who can beat Donald Trump. I'm the one who can unite this country. I can get those blue collar, former Democratic, now Trump voters. I can win them back. I'm the one who can heal this country. That's been his pitch. You're now seeing candidates go directly for that. During the debate, one of the candidates actually recalled being a young kid in California and hearing a senator say it's time for a new generation to take the torch.
I was 6 years old when a presidential candidate came to the California Democratic Convention and said, it's time to pass the torch to a new generation of Americans. That candidate was then Senator Joe Biden. Joe Biden was right when he said it was time to pass the torch to a new generation of Americans 32 years ago. He's still
at the debate, he shouted back,
I'm still holding on to that torch.
I mean, what is his response to that critique? And what is his offer? What is he offering voters?
His response is that he has the experience to go head to head with Donald Trump, that he has a lifetime of fighting for the little guy, is how he puts it. And, you know, he's got these roots in very blue collar America. He understands, you know, all sides of the Democratic base. I think where he's vulnerable is that that looks like he wants to take the country back to an era that many people believe doesn't exist anymore. You know, the Obama years, as fondly as Democrats remember them, are now very much in the past. You can't go back after a presidency like Donald Trump's. And I think there's a big question to be asked about how you move forward from that. And if, you know, hearkening back to these golden days of Barack Obama is really enough anymore. Do you need to sort of blow up the system like Bernie Sanders wants to do? Do you need that kind of change in the wake of, you know, electing Donald Trump?
This is really fascinating and goes to the heart of it. The Democrats are desperate to remove Donald Trump. And at the moment, they are kind of corralling around a kind of risk-averse option, in their view, someone like Joe Biden. But as you say, others think this is the moment to blow everything up. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders. I mean, he started saying this in 2016. And as we know, what people thought was the safe option then didn't win. Is he still getting traction now for 2020?
It's interesting because Bernie Sanders is sort of a victim of his own success.
Together, my friends, we have begun a political revolution to transform America, and that revolution, our revolution, continues.
By pulling the party so far left, by introducing ideas that were once ridiculed as crazy and pie in the sky, he's now brought the party with him, and many of the candidates running have adopted his ideas. Now, when you look at his healthcare plan, you know, a version of universal healthcare, most candidates will agree, actually, that's what we want. Not everyone has endorsed his exact plan, but many have, and that's quite a strong indicator of where the party is moving. But because of that, Bernie Sanders has also lost a lot of his initial support from 2016.
And what about Elizabeth Warren? She's got this kind of massive ideas and policy proposals. Is that working for her?
Elizabeth Warren is the progressive candidate that many liberals wanted to run against Hillary Clinton in 2016.
An open letter from more than 300 former Obama campaign staffers urging Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren to run for president.
But Bernie Sanders got there first, and so he took a lot of the support, and he's given a lot of credit for popularizing these really left-wing ideas. She started to gain in the polls. She's nipping at Bernie Sanders' heels. She's pulling from his support base. And it's mostly with her mantra of, I've got a plan.
2020 Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren is leading the pack when it comes to policy proposals. The Massachusetts senator has been putting out proposals at breakneck speed, so much so that Warren Has a Plan for It is being printed on T-shirts and tote bags sold on her website.
She has all these different plans to reform the healthcare system, but to reform public housing, opioid crisis, paid family leave, you name it, she truly has a plan for that.
I've got a plan for 1.2 million new manufacturing jobs across this
and
country.
And you're starting to see a lot of, especially women, turn towards Elizabeth Warren.
At the core of this is a kind of ideological divide over whether to take a more cautious approach against Trump or a more radical one. And we can see that through a number of policy areas: the climate crisis, the economy, immigration, and healthcare. Let's start with that. How controversial is it that candidates are talking about a state-funded system? I mean, it's really hard for us to understand here in the UK, where we love the NHS, and it isn't controversial at all.
That's definitely not the case here. This idea is being attacked by Donald Trump and the Republicans as full-blown socialism. They point to Venezuela and say, if we have universal health care, that's what's going to happen here. But I think it is significant. Obamacare has become, over time, the law of the land. Republicans have all but stopped trying to repeal that. And so there's been sort of this slow acceptance of a broader healthcare vision for the U.S. This movement, I would say, is predominantly led by young people, but you're seeing older people who've just had terrible experiences with the U.S. healthcare system, who had to sell homes to cover for cancer bills. I mean, you hear these stories all the time. So people are starting to be more open to these ideas.
Can we just talk about the issue of immigration? I mean, it's come to completely dominate American politics.
But all Americans are hurt by uncontrolled illegal migration.
I mean, we've seen some horrifying images from the border in recent weeks. who's going there? Who's visiting migrant detention centres? What are the kind of positions being taken on this?
So the question is probably who isn't visiting these detention centres? And they were trying to show that the Democratic Party is not Donald Trump's party. We welcome immigrants. We welcome asylum seekers. I think more broadly, we're just seeing Democrats be really put on the spot because for 2 years now, their immigration plan has been not what Donald Trump is doing. And now they're actually being pressed on the details of it. And they're being asked, okay, so if you're not going to do that, what are you going to do? And, you know, we do have 11 million undocumented people living in this country. Will you give them health care?
Raise your hand if your government plan would provide coverage for undocumented immigrants.
How are you going to, you know, bring them out of the shadows, so to speak? How will you resolve this crisis?
And the latest polling this week appears to show that this issue is bitterly partisan. 85% of Democrats believe refugees from Central America should be able to claim asylum. Only 31% of Republicans feel the same. But famously, the issue that really decides elections is the economy. And Donald Trump can point to the economy right now and tell a positive story. Does that make it extremely difficult for any of the Democratic candidates to challenge him in 2020?
Absolutely. That poses, I think, the most difficulty for candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who have to both argue that we need Donald Trump out, but that we need to fully restructure the US economy when it's doing well. How do you make that argument? A lot of the other candidates in the race have embraced this Green New Deal that was introduced by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the House.
Climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life, not just as a nation, but as a world.
The climate crisis is one of the top priorities for Democrats. That's new. It wasn't the case in elections before this.
They want to get rid of Donald Trump. They're arguing about who can defeat him and how they can best defeat him. And many think that Hillary Clinton lost partly because the US wasn't ready for a woman. And yet we've just discussed that two of the kind of breakthrough candidates, two of the people who are shaking up this race, are women. Do you think things have changed since 2016? Is the country ready for a female president?
I think the country has been ready for a female president for a long time. I think that what they're scared about is voters now, or especially now with Donald Trump in the White House, they're playing these games. Can a woman win in Wisconsin? And can she win with white voters? No one wants to take a chance on anything when the risk is losing to Donald Trump again for 4 years. What you saw with Kamala Harris's performance was an attempt to quiet those doubts, to say, I can not only do this, but let me show you how I'll do this. This is exactly how I'll prosecute the case against Donald Trump. And I could be as strong of a nominee as any of these men on stage.
So I can see how Kamala Harris was there trying to show people that she could take on some of the bigger characters and that she could be someone who cuts through.
And I will ensure this microphone that the President of the United States holds in her hand is used in a way that is about reflecting the values of our country.
But what critics might say is that what she was doing was invoking identity politics. And Donald Trump is somebody who literally rallies his base by pushing against identity politics. I mean, are those conversations happening then that there could be a danger in choosing someone like her?
Those conversations are definitely happening. Kamala Harris embraces identity politics. She says, you know, those who disagree with this term are basically discounting the experiences of women candidates, of people of color. She believes that we need to have these open conversations about race and gender. She's very forward on this issue, actually.
From my perspective, the term identity politics is the newest version of that phrase race card. So people will talk about, oh, we can't talk about identity politics, right? And so when they bring that up, it's meant to either marginalize the topic of discussion or to shut you up or to quiet you down.
There is a segment of Donald Trump's base that will respond positively if he goes after women and he goes after people of color. That's been true. We've seen that time and again. But I think there is a broader population of Republicans who are really turned off by this. So in the midterms, Donald Trump really tried to double down on immigration. He implemented these really, really hardline, aggressive policies that really tried to roil the country, to turn everything on the issues of race and identity. And in the end, Republicans lost. They actually lost badly, especially in these sort of suburban districts where former Republicans, people who mostly voted Republican, were really turned off by this. So we saw him defeated at the ballot box because of that. And not only that, but we saw him defeated by women and people of color. And I think that's what a lot of supporters of Kamala Harris and the other women and the other people of color in the race are looking to say, actually, these are our leaders. Hillary Clinton might have been the aberration. She might have just been a candidate with a lot of baggage. And none of these candidates are like that. They're new. They have different ideas. They come from different backgrounds and different experiences. So we can't totally compare them to Hillary Clinton.
But one thing that they're up against is some of the polling. I'm just looking at some here, which says that Donald Trump beats every major Democratic presidential candidate by a margin of 6 to 10 points among white voters, with one exception, Biden, where there is a statistical tie. I mean, that must make people pretty nervous.
And that's Biden's point. As he runs, he is someone who can win among all demographics. For Democrats, there's two theories of the case. One is the Biden approach, which is try to win back these voters who once voted for Obama and then voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Then there's another theory, which actually Barack Obama advanced, which is to really build this multiracial coalition, excite African-American voters, excite Latino voters, excite young people. And then you turn out this really big coalition of people who maybe aren't always involved in politics, but really are inspired by your candidacy. Kamala Harris is trying to do that. A few other candidates in the race are really trying to do that. Some Democrats, I think, see that as a dangerous approach because you can win California by 2 million votes and still lose the Electoral College, which is what we saw happen in 2016. So I think that's it's a part of the calculation that many Democratic voters are making, whether they ultimately try something new or if they, you know, go with the more risk-averse approach, is at the heart of this debate over who should be the nominee.
That was Lauren Gambino. Do keep up with all her reporting on this critical race at theguardian.com. Coming up, a change of leadership in the EU. Now, The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief, Daniel Boffey, on the new cast of characters set to take over key political roles in the European Union and what it all means for Brexit.
The first day back for MEPs after the European elections in Strasbourg was utter chaos. The Brexit Party turned their back as the Ode to Joy, the European Union's anthem, was played. They said it's not an anthem for them. Meanwhile, the Liberal Democrats were in yellow T-shirts emblazoned with the slogan, "Bollocks to Brexit." Back in Brussels, the real deal was going on. The European Union's leaders, 28 heads of state and government, were assembling over 50 hours of talks to decide who was going to fill those big roles. The first one would be, I suppose, the President of the European Commission, the one that's filled by Jean-Claude Juncker. Then we have President of the European Council, currently filled by Donald Tusk, and the President of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, currently has that job. Jean-Claude Juncker's last day as President of the Commission is the 31st of October. So we'll have a new President at the Commission from the 1st of November. The Belgian Prime Minister, Charles Michel, will be replacing Donald Tusk as President of the European Council. He is only 43 years old. He was Belgium's youngest ever Prime Minister. In terms of his politics, he's from the Liberal group. He is a federalist. He wants more integration. And he's an ally of Emmanuel Macron, the President of France. To fill the role at the European Central Bank, we have Christine Lagarde, who's currently Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. She is French. Ursula von der Leyen will be replacing Jean-Claude Juncker as President of the European Commission. She's Angela Merkel's Defence Secretary. The two big jobs, really, in terms of policymaking, are President of the European Commission and President of the European Central Bank. And for these two big jobs to go to women is symbolically very important. Ursula von der Leyen did come out as a bit of a surprise on some levels. The name popped up right at the end of 50 hours discussion. She's been around a long time. She's 60 years old. She came to politics very late, at the age of 42. She trained to be a gynecologist. She's had a career in all sorts of economics and as a doctor before she came into politics. She is an avowed federalist. She has backed a United States of Europe, in her own words, along the lines of a federal United States of America. She sees that as the way forward. She wants the national ties to be diluted. She believes in European sovereignty rather than national sovereignty. She believes that we're heading towards a European army. We're not there yet, but she sees the importance of greater integration on the military side. And all that will antagonise people back in the UK who are Brexiteers and who regard, so they might say, oh, well, this proves that we're better out than in. There'll be some in the UK who will think that a change of leadership in Brussels will mean a change of stance on Brexit, that the United Kingdom will suddenly reap a whole gamut of concessions. The threat of a no deal and the departure of the likes of Jean-Claude Juncker will see the UK prosper. I think in reality that very, very little change. Brussels end, there's resolve to stick to the line they've taken in terms of no negotiation of a withdrawal agreement. Indeed, Ursula von der Leyen has said before she came into this job that they need to be tough in negotiation, they need to ensure that the Irish border was kept open, and if needs be, you know, she's against a no deal, of course, and it'd be the worst possible start for a future relationship with Britain, she said. But if necessary, they need to prepare for it. Charles Michel, who's the new European Council president, he was very much of the opinion that the UK shouldn't be given a long extension when that came up in April. He thought we should only have a short extension, puts the UK Parliament under pressure. So he's pretty tough. He's a lot tougher, I would say, than Donald Tusk, who's the outgoing president of the European Council. In reality, yeah, this is all bad news if Boris Johnson, the Tory leadership frontrunner, thinks it's going to reap some dividends from this. I'm afraid it's all bad news for him.
That was Daniel Boffey. My thanks to him and to Lauren Gambino. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Zoe Gelber. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.